30 professional counterparts in a macroeconomics project had died in the first 2 years of the project from AIDS. And this was a project where our counterparts were senior officials of the central bank and the Ministry of Finance. And from there, which was already a quite brutal realization, because I had only thought about AIDS a little bit out of the, just the corner of my eye, and there it was, with the pandemic in full fury, staring me in the face. I then saw more malaria than I had ever thought about, expected to see. The fact that people, whether wealthy or poor, were laid low by malaria. So many stories of people dying, even students that had returned home after studies abroad. And the sense of disease grew very quickly on me. And coming from outside of the field, it led me to ask a basic question, which is, what's going on here? Why is there so much sense of disease? Is Africa different in this regard? What would explain that? What's being done about it? And 10 years later, I'm happy to be on a faculty at the School of Public Health, which is a macroeconomist I did not expect to be early on, because that was a new direction that led me to reconsider a lot about development economics itself, especially the failure of traditional development economics to take seriously disease ecology and the role of health and disease in shaping overall development progress or regress of different parts of the world. Well, the answers were rather stark. First, even aside from the AIDS pandemic, Africa really was and is an outlier in the state of public health. There is considerably more infectious disease burden and considerably higher mortality rates of children, of adults, but particularly of children, than in any other part of the world, even after controlling for income levels. It's not simply a reflection of Africa's extreme poverty, though it is in part a reflection of that. Other very poor parts of the world tend to have better health profiles in the sense of lower infant and child mortality, lower maternal mortality rates, and higher life expectancy rates than Africa. And really a considerable difference statistically, at least making a simple comparison controlling for income levels of life expectancy or child mortality. Africa is essentially the only region in the world where a large swath of the region has child mortality rates of 200 or higher per 1,000 live births. In other words, 200 of every 1,000 live births, children not surviving till their fifth birthday. This is absolutely shocking. Africa has, in large parts of the continent, up to 1,000 mothers dying in childbirth for every 100,000 live births. Infant mortality rates well above 100 per 1,000 live births. Life expectancy in the 30s in the AIDS-impacted countries, particularly in southern and eastern Africa, in the 40s in parts of sub-Saharan Africa without such a high AIDS prevalence, but with the background of other massive infectious diseases. There is something different and particular about Africa's public health disasters. I asked myself two other questions, which I continue to ask, and which I'll try to give you some reflections on today. Well, actually, three more questions. First, why? What accounts for this pervasive health crisis? And that's a lot of what I want to talk about, because we can't fix it until we understand it. And so I want to talk about the multifactorial explanations for this very high level of morbidity and mortality, high beyond the direct contribution of extreme poverty itself. itself. Though extreme poverty definitely is a major risk factor, if you will, because it affects many, many aspects of health-seeking and health-attaining behavior. That was one set of issues. Second set of issues was whether there are approaches that could address these horrible facts, and what are we doing about bringing those approaches and those tools to bear. And what I discovered for myself, it's not an original discovery, but it's a discovery that you make yourself as you start to dig into this, is how shockingly little the world was doing, and in many ways is still doing, though it's doing more than it used to be doing, about this health crisis. When I started digging through the conflicting data, and especially through the conflicts of high-minded speeches and very low-minded actual performance of the rich world as it was addressing the crisis of Africa, it turned out that at the end of the 90s, almost nothing was being done about the AIDS pandemic. It was, in essence, a pandemic that was being allowed to run its natural, horrible course. Africans were not on treatment. Prevention efforts were minimal. Prevalence rates were continuing to rise. Incidence rates remained at horribly high levels. Total rich country spending for Africa in the late 1990s on AIDS was about $90 million a year, at a time when there were already about 25 million HIV-infected individuals. You can do the arithmetic. It's essentially doing nothing. And it's always good to remember to have a denominator. That's one of the good tricks of macroeconomics. What is $90 million? My denominator for most things in the world is how much we spend in one day on the Pentagon budget. Because that helps you get a sense of how we devote our resources and what we might actually do to find some money. So today's Pentagon budget is $1.5 billion per day. So this was $90 million per year from the whole world to fight AIDS in Africa, compared to $1.5 billion per day. Now, at the time, it was only $1 billion a day. But the same idea applies. I also found that malaria was about the same, roughly $90 to $100 million a year spent by the rich world to control malaria in Africa, which is a disease that causes about 500 million clinical cases a year, by some estimates, a billion clinical cases a year, and causes between 2 and 3 million deaths per year. And what we're spending was $90 million from the rich world. It's hard to find this number, by the way, because the rich world obfuscates how little it does, often by grandiose speeches and high-minded rhetoric and fancy programs. But you might want to check last week's Lancet for a skewering of the World Bank's malaria programs after the year 2000, after they promised a $300 to $500 million malaria effort, and the paper shows that they essentially did nothing, and then disguised the fact by a lot of hand-waving about how much they were doing. It's really well worth reading, Lancet, on the World Bank's malaria control effort by Amir Attaran and co-authors. Pretty devastating, actually. So devastating that the bank's response was, we're trying harder now. rather than really refuting anything that was written. I also learned, especially from my wife, who's a pediatrician and a public health specialist, but also from many other colleagues, that the causes, approximately, of all of this disease and mortality, had also effective public health responses. I was asked in the year 2000 and 2001 to head a commission for the World Health Organization, starting to look at what could be done by if more financial resources could be mobilized. And the point in terms of proximate cause of illness, not ultimate cause, but proximate cause, is that about eight conditions accounted for the vast proportion of the excess disease and mortality burden in Africa compared to the high-income world. AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, diarrheal disease, acute lower respiratory infection, vaccine-preventable diseases, other parasitic infections, eukaryotic parasites like Helminth infections, lymphatic filariasis, schistosomiasis, onchocerciasis, trichomculiasis, trypanosomiasis. All that cluster of eukaryotic parasites. Micronutrient deficiencies, vitamin A, iodine, iron in some cases, and maternal death in childbirth. And that accounts for the huge proportion of the excess disease burden. And every one of those causes has both preventative and therapeutic protocols that can make a huge difference at quite low cost. AIDS is the most expensive of the therapies, but even that, you know, now with antiretroviral medicines, pricing has been reduced to one pill in the morning, one pill in the evening for 30 cents a day, or $130 a year for a course of antiretrovirals. So even that, the most expensive of all of these, is really a very, very low-cost option. So there were things that could be done. And then we started to make some calculations about how to do it. Now, that initial entry for me was mainly about proximate cause of disease, how to prevent it, how to treat it. In other words, very much a public health topic. After 2001, I was asked by Secretary General Kofi Annan to help work with him on the Millennium Development Goals. Those are goals that were adopted by the world's governments in September 2000 that called upon the world to partner to fight these scourges by fighting disease, hunger, isolation, lack of access to infrastructure, extreme income poverty. And for me, that was an opportunity also to understand more aspects of extreme poverty, but also to understand even more aspects of the disease environment and a fuller accounting of where Africa's extreme disease burden comes from. And so it fills out the picture by taking the public health system and putting it in a broader context of poverty, natural hazards, disease ecology, and other risks that Africa faces, which are quite distinctive because of Africa's geography and other problems. And that's what I want to talk about now, a broader picture of this crisis, and therefore a somewhat broader idea of how this crisis can be addressed. Now, let me say that I regard the topics that I'm going to talk about, especially the response, as truly the number one challenge facing public health. Now, that's a little unfair. It's the one I'm interested in, but it's I believe, the most urgent life and death issue that public health faces. And it poses a particular problem that comes under the rubric of scaling up. I'll talk about diagnosis of what's happening and then response. The responses are how to bring public health prevention, public health treatment, and other kinds of interventions, safe drinking water and so on, to bear on behalf of extremely poor people. In a microcosm, we know how to do that because we know, quote-unquote, if there's vitamin A deficiency, there are protocols for how to address that. If a child is parasitized by helminths, there are albendazole, mebendazole to treat them. And all of that is quite well understood. But the issue for public health is the population response, of course. How can you get those medicines to 500 million impoverished people in a short period of time? So as I talk about approaches...
You want to try this, or?
Yeah, sure. As I talk about approaches, think about scaling up as a very critical part of the challenge. In other words, here are solutions. Can they be made to work at broad scale? And I want to have a department in all schools of public health called the Department of Scaling Up. And really, because I think that for the next 10 or 20 years, it's one of the great analytical issues regarding very poor countries. It's the challenge of a health system, but not health systems as we know it here, where we're trying to fix the uninsured, or we're trying to reduce costs, or we're trying to add efficiency, but health systems in the more precise sense. When you start with nothing, how do you get somewhere in real time? When there are no clinics, when there are no health workers, when the trained workers have already left for other places in the world, how do you get started and how do you get mass coverage in a short period of time? It's a great issue. Nobody knows the answer to it because it unfortunately hasn't really been tried adequately yet, though now it's being tried in a variety of senses. And we'll see if we can find some good answers. And I hope that Mailman is in the forefront of trying to find some of those good answers. I don't know if we could turn the lights down a little bit. Probably would help. Probably up here, right?
There.
Good. Okay. That's good. Oh, that's bad. Yes, but I don't mean it. Okay. All right, sit back and enjoy the show. No. Why don't we turn the lights off so you can see? Okay. Actually, it's nothing enjoyable. I should not joke. This is Zamba Central Hospital in a visit that I made in January, just 3 months ago. These are children all in an acute malaria burden, most with cerebral malaria. And it was a shocking sight because while I've been seeing malaria for years, I never saw so many children suffering and packed one after another in coma. Children dying because Malawi, one of the poorest countries in the world, one of the places with a child mortality rate of probably about 200, I don't know the exact number right now, is an example of the confluence of risk factors that I'm going to talk about, which all add up to an absolutely horrific and still increasing burden. So children in coma, one after another, in packed wards, hundreds and hundreds of kids, undernourished, coming for emergency nutritional supplementation, in coma. It was absolutely shocking and horrible, but the kind of thing that in one form or another you would see in almost any part of Africa today. This is a different side of the problem, and I'm going to try to come at this problem from a number of perspectives. This is a scene in northern Ethiopia last year where the Earth Institute is working together with a set of villages in Tigray province, Ethiopia, And what's shown here is water as a central crisis. Water is a central crisis of disease. Water is a central crisis of poverty in much of the world. This is a very desperate scene, something that I had never seen before, being taken out to this place. This is a river, actually. It's a riverbed for a set of villages, but the river has run dry. The rains have failed in this region now for a number of years. There is pervasive drought in the Horn of Africa. The men are out there this morning digging a hole in the middle of the riverbed to get to the water table, which is a few feet below the surface. And it was a new concept for me, digging a hole in your river to try to get to the water. It is a desperate attempt to survive. They were carrying the water up to the fields for emergency irrigation. This is a map from the Food Agriculture Organization, FAO, at the end of 2005. You can see what it says. It says, countries require urgent external assistance. That's a grim picture. Basically, we have a generalized crisis in Africa of extreme rural distress. It's a crisis of extreme poverty, hunger, and disease, all wrapped up into one. What this particular map is about is requiring external food assistance. This is for a food monitoring unit of the United Nations. And what's shown here is how pervasive the hunger crisis in Africa is. And hunger, of course, is one of the major determinants of disease state as well. And so what's reflected here, as I'll show in just a moment, is a food production crisis, which is turning into a generalized food intake crisis, which is turning into a deep, pervasive, and increasing undernourishment crisis, which then shows up in massive morbidity and mortality, particularly of young children. And the extent of it is utterly amazing. The one dot, by the way, in the center there, you see which country that is? We're in Rwanda. Is not even right. This, you know, suggests that Rwanda doesn't have the crisis. We have again, a set of intervention villages at the Earth Institute in Rwanda, and there has been a huge, huge influx of desperately hungry and indeed dying people in the middle of a food crisis because of failed rains in Rwanda early this year. And so maybe this was right as of December 2005, but it's no longer true today. Rwanda as well, and perhaps some of the countries in West Africa would also be part of this this crisis. So when we look at this disease crisis, it's a confluence of several basic conditions. First, pervasive hunger, pervasive chronic undernourishment, which has many causes. Undernourishment itself is often disease-induced, not just disease-causing. If you have parasites, if you have pathogens, bacterial pathogens that cause diarrhea and so forth, that can, of course, destroy the uptake of macro and micronutrients. So hunger itself can be a reflection of, or undernutrition can be a reflection of disease. But in this case, undernutrition is also a reflection of dietary intake being insufficient, which itself is a reflection of the low levels of food production and extreme poverty in Africa. So that's factor number one. Disease ecology is factor number two. Africa, I'll show in a couple of minutes, is uniquely prone to a set of highly pernicious infectious diseases, probably with a unique a uniquely devastating disease ecology compared to any other part of the world. Third is the lack of infrastructure of all kinds. Health depends on built infrastructure. First, of course, it depends on safe drinking water. And a very large proportion of the disease burden is directly or indirectly related to the lack of safe drinking water. Of course, the lack of water also for agriculture is another part of the hunger crisis. But even when there is water, the water tends to be unsafe, filled with pathogens transmitting a whole host of parasitic diseases and diarrheal diseases. And that's one part of the lack of infrastructure. Another part is the pervasive lack of transport. When you get sick, what do? There is not proximity for most people to a clinic nearby, nor is there public transport, even a truck, a bus, certainly no ambulance service for most of rural Africa. So mothers carry their children, often many hours in search of a clinic, to reach a clinic, and often by the time that they get there, they find that the clinic is not staffed or doesn't have the medicines. So lack of transport infrastructure is another major part of the health crisis. So too is the lack of communications infrastructure. There's no way to call ahead. There's no electricity. There's no electricity typically to keep vials of medicine in a cold chain, to be able to sterilize equipment, to send an email message or make a phone call. And so the lack of electricity and telecommunications is another part of that broader lack of infrastructure. And a specific feature is the lack of public health services generally. Whether it's simple prevention, like access to an anti-malaria bed net, which is an extremely powerful, low-cost intervention that can reduce all-cause mortality of young children in an endemic malarious region by 20 or 25%. That's all-cause mortality. But it doesn't exist for most children in malarious Africa. Two fancier kinds of interventions, particularly clinical services, also not available for most people. So these are the burdens of extreme poverty, that in all counts, you have this confluence of factors which are synergistic and lead to a massive disease burden. Now, the massive disease burden is one of the factors also that contributes to poverty. Certainly, spells of serious illness are very frequently causes of families going from bare survival into a downward spiral of debt and often further disease and death by having to sell assets, selling cows, selling land, losing everything in order to fight a particular episode of disease or to address a chronic and debilitating disease. So disease causes poverty, then poverty in turn contributes to all of these other risk factors. Let me start with the hunger crisis. Africa stands out not only in disease, but in being the only region of the developing world for which there has been a decline rather than an increase of food output per person during the last 40 years. This is the famous Malthusian crisis, if you will, that if the population is rising rapidly, as it has been in Africa, and there is not technological improvement in the ability to grow food, and the ability to expand land area is also limited, then it's quite possible that food production will be outstripped by population. And this is what's happened in Africa. To start with the index of 100 in 1961, food output per capita rose by about 20% for the world as a whole, by about 50% in East Asia, by about 10% in South Asia, but fell by almost 20%, and it would probably be down around here by now, in sub-Saharan Africa. So start from the fact that there is a food output crisis. The causes of this are complex, but essentially come down to this remarkable crisis. This now is a different measure. It's the output, not per person, but the output of food per hectare of land on the farm. A hectare being, remember, about 2.5 acres for the Americans here. And what's happened in Africa is that the food yield, particularly of cereal staples like maize, has been almost unchanged in yield over the last 45 years. This is incredible. This means almost no technological progress, no scientific advance in the food output per hectare compared with all of the other parts of the world. All parts of the developing world started out around that 1 hectare per 1 ton, 1 metric ton of cereal per hectare. But look what happened in South Asia. It rose to about 2.5 tons per hectare by now. Look what happened in Latin America. Yields rose to about 3 metric tons per hectare. Look at what happened in East Asia. Yields of cereals, mainly rice in this case, rose to about 4.5 tons per hectare. So the rest of the world had a big increase of agricultural production per unit of land, whereas Africa had none. But at the same time, Africa's population more than doubled during this period, well more than doubled, approximately quadrupled. Land area expanded a bit, mainly by chopping down rainforest and moving into more marginal grassland areas, often in very difficult environments, but yields did not go up. So what's happening here? Why is this? Basically, a shorthand, we don't have time to talk about it at length, a shorthand is that the rest of the world experienced what came to be called a Green Revolution, which was a major advance in crop productivity that came through a package of technologies, improved seed varieties by breeding of high-yield seeds, combined with a heavier input of fertilizer, combined with water management, usually through irrigation. And in Asia, that package of high-yield seeds, irrigation, and fertilizer led to the doubling or tripling or quadrupling of food output per hectare. But in Africa, with the impoverishment of the rural areas and it being rain-fed agriculture rather than irrigation-based agriculture, if you go to a rural area in most of sub-Saharan Africa, farmers are not using irrigation because they're not living in river sheds that can easily be irrigated. They're depending on the rains. Usually basic technologies, even to harvest the rains, are financially out of reach for these farmers. They're living far from roads and from city areas, and they can't afford fertilizer inputs. And without fertilizer and water, they can't afford and don't choose to use high-yield variety seeds because it's all a package. So the farm inputs that are actually being used in Africa are the same as they were 40 years ago. And this is quite shocking, because without high-yield seed varieties, without water management, without fertilizer, it has not been possible for Africa to keep up with the population growth. So the hunger crisis has gotten deeper and deeper. Now, most Africans, actually a sheer majority, are farm families. And so this is also a cause of poverty, not only a cause of hunger. Farmers are just not growing enough to earn a proper income. What this graph shows is the low level of fertilizer input in Africa compared with the other parts of the developing world where there's been a huge increase of fertilizer use in the last 40 years. Another interesting thing, very quickly, is if you plant crops and harvest them, but don't put in fertilizer, each crop you take out takes out the nutrients from the soil along with the crop. I didn't really realize this till it was explained to me by my agronomist colleagues. But you put in the fertilizer not just to feed the plant, but because the soil reservoir of nutrients is depleted by the crop itself each season. So you have to replace those nutrients. If you don't, there will not be the nitrogen, potassium, phosphorus, but particularly the nitrogen, needed to grow a decent crop. In other words, Africa's crops are being starved, and the result is that so too are the people. At the core of the crisis is a nitrogen drought. There's not enough nitrogen in the soils. That leads to low yields. That leads to increasing hunger. Now, one very good piece of news, if you go back here, this is the yield that farmers are actually getting, according to recent observations, about half a ton per hectare. This is what you can get if you use fertilizer and water management. This is on research stations, not using unproved or experimental technologies, but rather what's called best option technologies. In other words, take the best you have available, grow it at the agriculture station, and look at what can be achieved, 3 or 4 tons per hectare in Africa, compared to what's actually being achieved. That's very good news. It means with a concerted effort to help farmers use improved seed and fertilizer and better water management, it would be possible for Africa to double or triple or quadruple its food production. And that would be a huge benefit for fighting the hunger crisis. Now, disease ecology, a second factor. Disease ecology is one of the most important dimensions of public health. And I'll just spend 2 minutes on what I regard as a fascinating story, very troubling and fascinating, and that's the malaria burden in Africa. Africa has about 90% of the world's malaria cases right now. That's because malaria in Africa has always been the worst, and because malaria has been more controlled in every other part of the world. Now, why is this? Well, some people say, well, Africa didn't try very hard to control malaria. We had malaria, but we controlled it. Why can't African countries do the same? This is a constant refrain that I hear by people that don't know very much. And that's most people, by the way. Which is why it's good that you're studying, because you'll know something. And most people don't know anything. Their opinions are stronger, because you know there are doubts to things, but their opinions are very strong and usually misguided. So it turns out that Africa's malaria burden is very high because of its particular disease ecology. Climate and type of vector. Now, how is malaria transmitted?
Mosquito.
Which kind of mosquito?
Anopheles,
right? It's the one genus of mosquito that transmits malaria. But there are hundreds of species of Anopheles. And Africa has the worst of all of them in terms of what's called the competence of the vector to transmit the disease among humans. So what is Africa's species of Anopheles? Anybody know?
Egypti?
What?
Egypti?
No. Because Aedes aegypti is a different genus as well.
Anopheles gambi.
And this is the main, most lethal transmitter of malaria because the Anopheles gambi and its relatives, Arabiensis and Funestus, which is all this cluster of dominant vectors, are human-biting mosquitoes as opposed to mosquitoes in other parts of the world which divide their bites between the cattle and the humans. And if you live among mosquitoes that are cattle biters, not just human biters, that breaks the human-to-human transmission. But in Africa, the Anopheles gambi and Arabiensis and Funestus are 100% human biters. Very interesting story. Oops, sorry. The result is dreadful. And if you calculate an epidemiological measure called vectorial competence, you come up with this map. This is a map that colleagues and I put together a few years ago, which shows not where malaria is transmitted, but where the ecology of transmission, combining the type of mosquito and the climate, come together to produce the highest rate of transmission. Now, how does climate affect malaria transmission? Anybody know? I don't know. Anybody could put a hand up and give a coherent explanation. Yes?
I don't know. I'm trying to remember something from like the intro environmental course.
Good.
But isn't there something about like the heat and like in heat, like somehow they're able to reproduce more frequently?
Yeah, basically, yes. Yes. It's not a virus. Pathogen. It's a protozoa. Right. Okay, so basically, you have a little bit of the right idea. Yeah, mostly the right idea. The mosquito bites an infected person. It takes up the parasite into its gut in the sex stage of the mosquito, what's called the gametocyte phase. There is the parasites mate inside the gut of the mosquito host. They undergo a life cycle change. They migrate back to the salivary gland of the mosquito. Then the mosquito bites someone else and transmits a different stage of the infection called the sporozoite stage, which is the one that then goes to the liver and then to the red blood cells. That process of going from gametocytes to sporozoites is a process called sporogeny. It is temperature dependent. The warmer the temperature, the faster is sporogeny. Speed matters because mosquitoes have a life expectancy of about 2 weeks. And sporogeny has a time period of about 2 weeks. So it's a race against time whether this mosquito will ever be infected. The warmer the temperature, the longer the mosquito lives within a range, and the shorter is the time period of sporogeny. And it turns out that you need about 18 degrees centigrade in order to sustain malaria transmission. It can't be sustained in the winter because the mosquito dies before sporogeny takes place. Africa is hot, tropical. So very quick sporogeny, long-lived, anthropophagic mosquitoes. What's anthropophagic?
Biting
people, okay? So long-lived, anthropophagic mosquitoes, you put it all together, it really sucks, to use the technical term. Malaria is extremely heavily transmitted in Africa, particularly where? From the map. Which part of Africa? West Africa. West Africa was called the white man's graveyard in the 19th century because when the Europeans tried to colonize Africa, they all died on the coast. Until what happened? Quinine. Until quinine was invented and then Africa was taken over by European imperial powers in the second part of the 19th century. But this incredible burden is very much along the coast of West Africa. What disease is associated with malaria that shows us the genetic imprint of long-lasting malaria burden in West Africa? Sickle cell anemia, which when the sickle allele is inherited heterozygously is mildly protective against malaria. And so sickle cell anemia, which is overwhelmingly in African and African-American populations, is a reflection of this very high disease burden, particularly in West Africa. And this is just to show how much of an extra burden Africa has in controlling disease. It's like the extra burden of having grain-fed agriculture rather than irrigation-based agriculture the same way. It's just another burden that has to be faced. Now, there are many, many other so-called eukaryotic parasites that have a similar tropical disease ecology with a particular footprint in Africa, and I mentioned them before. The soil-transmitted helminths, hookworm, Ascaris, and Trichuris, and then many of the other vector-borne diseases like lymphatic filariasis, which is elephantiasis, onchocerciasis, which is African river blindness, trypanosomiasis, which is African sleeping sickness, and trochunculiasis, which is African guinea worm. Thank you for all saying it, but under your breath. Lots of overlap. This is an overlap of hookworm and malaria, the red shaded areas. In the places where we are working in Africa, the Earth Institute, the children are polyparasitized. They may have three or five, four or five of these parasites at the same time. Schistosomiasis with a snail vector. Then infrastructure, and I don't have enough maps of the miserable infrastructure of Africa, but this is one comparison. This is Africa's rail network, network in quotation marks. This is India's rail network. And the road system is about the same. Fiber optic cable would be even more dramatic difference. These roads would be similar. So long story of lack of investment in African infrastructure, and from, I don't know, not kind of immemorial, but for certainly the last couple of millennia, much lower population densities in Africa than in India, and therefore less economics of building the transport network. Why would the population density be lower in Africa than in India? More people in India, yes. That's what would be called a proximate cause. But why? No? Why? Why does nobody live in the desert?
No swimming pools.
Food. Food and water. So Africa being drier, less able to grow food, less irrigation, less population density, less infrastructure development, more economic isolation. These are all risk factors for disease. So what's needed, and I'm going to stop in just 2 minutes because unfortunately I'm going to have to leave early, but I want to save time for at least a couple of questions. What's needed is an integrated strategy that addresses the hunger crisis. We call it helping to promote an African Green Revolution. It addresses directly the disease burden by providing preventative and clinical health services. Okay? It addresses the infrastructure challenge of lack of roads, power, transport, communications. All of which is solvable, it just costs money. And it should address the direct availability of clinical care. And what we're doing at the Earth Institute, based on recommendations that the UN Millennium Project has made, the project that I have been directing for the Secretary General, we're trying to put into place an integrated strategy at the village scale to address the public health facilities, the basic infrastructure, the hunger crisis, and the disease epidemiology all together. Turns out, our theory is that this can be done for about $110 per capita per year. Not a lot of money. And since some of it can be paid for locally, what we're asking for and recommending is that donors contribute about $70 per person per year in the villages to help invest in infrastructure, clinical services, improved agricultural production, and so on, as a way to overcome this interconnected poverty, hunger, and disease crisis. So it's trying to take a holistic approach at low cost through a cost-effective investments around these multidimensional reasons for the health and the poverty crisis. And the project specifically in the rural areas is called the Millennium Villages Project. And the Earth Institute has it underway in 10 countries, 12 locations of sub-Saharan Africa. And it's based on community leadership and empowerment by donors in growing more food, landscape management for water conservation and soil conservation, nutrient supplementation. In this case, this is a school feeding program that we're introducing in all of the villages. Provision of clinical services, and here is the community literally building the clinic for the village cluster in western Kenya. And the idea is that by putting these interventions together, it should be possible to make a decisive progress in reducing the disease burden and empowering families to earn more income. The claim is that doing that for a few years will then become sustainable out of domestic, local resources by raising the incomes of these communities. So one test of this is not only improving the outcomes, but improving them while also raising income levels in the community so that the community can then take on some of this, if not all of this, challenge in later years. And we're hoping for a transition to really full sustainability within a decade. And we don't have time to discuss it, but the idea of helping to commercialize agriculture so that by export earnings, these communities can start earning cash income. One more point that's important. It's very important for sustainability and for overcoming the health crisis that there also should be a demographic transition, meaning a transition not only from high mortality to low mortality, but from high fertility to low fertility. Interestingly, countries with high child mortality have faster population growth than countries with low child mortality. And I think the causal reason is that when child mortality is high, risk-averse households compensate by having very large families because they're not sure about the survival of each child. When child survival is more assured and a set of other things is also done, the fertility rate can come down quite quickly. The package of achieving a fertility reduction seems to be child survival, girls' and mothers' literacy, economic opportunity for mothers outside of the household, and the availability of contraception and family planning. that seems to be the mix that promotes a fast transition from high fertility rates to low fertility rates. And it's a major improvement in the life chances of children when they're born into a family of two or three siblings rather than six or seven siblings. Because a poor family can't afford to provide the nutrition, the education, and the health for a family of seven children, but might be able to do so for a family of two to three children. Why don't we see if we could turn on the lights? So, the conclusion of this is the following. Africa has an unprecedented disease burden. There is no simple explanation for it. The overarching explanation is a situation of extreme poverty. But it shows up as part of a hunger crisis, which itself is a food crisis, an infrastructure crisis, and directly a lack of public health services. My theory, the theory of my colleagues at the Earth Institute, the theory of the Millennium Villages Project, is that through community-led development, it should be possible to introduce effective investments to address each of these reasons for the disease crisis and the mortality crisis. It should be possible to raise food production, improve infrastructure, provide clinical and preventative public health services, and increase incomes in a sustainable fashion. I hope that's right, because we're spending a lot of effort on testing this proposition now in 10 countries in Africa, the Millennium Villages Project. We're always looking for volunteers, interns, people interested. If you are interested in one way or another, let me know by email. Not that everybody that's interested can be accommodated, but I do believe that this is a very fascinating project for people to be involved either in library of research work or in the field in some way or another. So I just raise that. If all of this is right, not all of it, even if it's pretty good account of this challenge, it suggests that there should be a public policy approach that can make a huge difference, that could save millions of lives per year, actually reduce rather than increase population growth, and help an impoverished region of the world to escape from poverty over the longer term. That's my belief, that it's possible and right. But if it is right, there's one major additional issue, which I didn't have time to talk about, which is the scaling up issue. Because there probably are 100,000 villages in Africa that face this kind of crisis. Each village, 5,000 people, that is, 500 million impoverished rural Africans. Now, there are gradations, but it's a lot of villages and a lot of suffering. Could this kind of approach be scaled up if the financial resources were available? Again, my hypothesis is yes, but there are a few dollars here and there. And what we're trying to do is not only show how interventions proximately could improve the situation, we're trying to devise a new approach to development aid so that this kind of scaling up of public health services could be achieved in a short period of time, and other services could be achieved in a short period of time. As just one example, just one little example, and then I'll stop. We champion the free distribution on a mass basis of insecticide-treated bed nets to protect against malaria in the same way that UNICEF has been delivering free immunizations in national immunization campaigns for the last 25 years. And we're working now with UNICEF and the American Red Cross and others for that kind of mass distribution of bed nets. It's been shown that in about 6 days, it's possible to get bed nets out to 70 or 80% of the households in an impoverished place like Togo. And if that's true, it shows that if you think creatively about how to get the scaling up done, that's just one example. I believe that it should be possible. That's probably an easier case than many others. But that it should be possible to bring about this kind of quick scaling up. There are lots of ifs in this. That's why it's intellectually as well as emotionally a fascinating and important set of problems, and it's one that I hope at least some of you will be engaged in professionally. Thanks very much.
Time is tight, but we do have time for a couple of questions. If
please.
I was wondering, in terms of what you discussed on economic possibilities as achieving the first rung of the global economic ladder, does Africa yet fit into that, or will they after 10 years of sustainability?
So I have a kind of a metaphor that I use, which is getting onto the first rung of the ladder of development, because once you're on a ladder, you can pay steps. The steps are better education, saving, capital accumulation, attracting foreign investment, and so on. But the first rung might be pretty high up, so you just can't get your foot on it because you're hungry, you're sick, and so forth. So the idea that I am promoting is that you kind of give the boost, or the to use another cliche, which is okay, a hand up rather than a hand out. You help to get the communities, the countries, onto the first rung of the ladder of development. And for me, that means growing enough food, having commercial agriculture where you're actually earning income, and having enough income that at least basic services can be provided, safe drinking water, adequate basic diets, and so on. Probably it's still a pretty low rung. It's by any recognizable standard poverty. But what I'm looking for is the first rung, meaning out of the extreme, it can kill you every day kind of poverty. Yes?
Just a couple questions. One in for the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Is the anopheles, is that at night loving like the few white species, or is it day loving like the aedes?
So,
the second question, why is it?
Yeah.
Is that millennium development goals? What do you think of, I know the goal is by 2015 to halt and reverse the spread of AIDS.
Right.
What do you think of that in light of the current events?
Yeah. So first on the anopheles, they come in all different types. Daytime, nighttime, endophagic, and exophagic, biting indoors and outdoors. Anthropophagic animal biting. So there are lots of different behaviors. But the dominant kind is indoor biting between dusk and dawn. And that's why indoor spraying with DDT or indoor or other pesticides or indoor use of insecticide-treated nets is effective. Because the mosquitoes are generally resting on the walls of the huts at night and then biting inside. DDT, by the way, when used not as an outdoor pesticide in large quantities on crops, but used in a very thin film on the indoor of walls of houses and huts, is a very effective repellent and mosquitocide. And so it's part of the mix. Nets are going to be easier to use and reliable, but DDT also plays a role. And in terms of stopping the AIDS pandemic, that whole phrasing in the Millennium Development Goals is ambiguous. It's not even clearly put, because it's not put like a professional public health statement would be put in terms of incidence and prevalence rate, so nobody knows exactly what it means. Is the question, could you get the prevalence rates heading down and incidence rates vastly reduced compared to now? Certainly yes. And we're even seeing a topping off of prevalence rates right now in some places. Partly there's a dying off of people that are in advanced HIV disease, but there seems to be at least some reduction of incidence rates in some of the places that had hugely high pandemics in recent years. So maybe there's the beginning of a turning point. Maybe one more. Yeah. Yeah. First, I'm not so good at war zones. I really dislike bullets. So I don't work in refugee camps. I'm not an expert in immediate post-war reconstruction. What I'm talking about here is longer-term systemic building. The closest we're coming right now is in Liberia, where we're hoping to use this as part of the recovery process. And there, the countryside has been secured, more or less, I understand, by decommissioning of children soldiers and the militias and so forth, turning in guns, peace agreement, and peacekeeping forces. So all of those things have apparently reduced rural insecurity and violence very, very much. And then comes the time for this kind of building. What I do believe is that in crises like Darfur, it's a mistake, in my view, to put all the focus just on the military and the peacekeeping discussions rather than also at least laying out a development agenda to help the combatants see that there's a better future for them if they'll put down the guns. And I don't think in Darfur we've done that enough. There isn't a development plan that's been put on the table as an inducement for peace. Only the talk about insisting on state action and on peacekeeping troops. And I think the lack of a clear discussion about a development agenda is a big mistake, because I think it slowed actually reaching an agreement among the combatants. That's a guess. I'm not there. It's always hazardous to guess about places you don't know firsthand. But my experience is that putting the vision of what could happen is very powerful in terms of getting people to reach agreements. And so at least the development agenda always should be there as part of the vision of where you'd like to go once the peace is secured, at least in a rudimentary way. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and after during the break, you can now hand your paper to the CPA.
though. There are a couple of announcements on the board.
Take a look at them.
All right. We've got about an hour or so left in the semester. What I want to do for most of that time is talk a little bit about some themes that emerge when you compare the healthcare system in the United States with the healthcare system in other Western industrialized countries. Now, clearly, this is a big leap and a big jump and a big difference from what Jeff was just talking about with the world in sub-Saharan Africa. But I want to switch gears with us now. And I had you read some general overviews of the healthcare system in places like Germany and Canada and Great Britain and France and some of the Western industrialized countries. I don't want to take a lot of time, I don't want to take any time today, actually, tonight, going through the specifics of the Canadian system versus the German system versus the British system versus the, you know, the French system. You know, that you can read on your own, that I think you've got the background to read, and that I think will just send us down a path which isn't particularly fruitful. What I do want to do is take a few minutes to talk about some themes that emerge when you compare the United States to any of those countries and to all those countries put together. What can we say about the United States and how it differs or how it's similar to some of those other countries? Just to start the discussion, let me point out the obvious, which is that the United States spends extraordinarily more on healthcare than does any other country in the world. And of course it has 46 million uninsured to boot. But just to give you an example, the OECD, which ranks the top, I don't know, 30 or so Western industrialized countries of the world and gives statistics on their healthcare spending and costs and utilization alike, the average per capita spending of OECD nations in the world is $2,193 a year, which is about 8.5% of the gross domestic product of those countries. In the United States, we spend $5,267 a year per capita, about 14.5% of our gross domestic product. And these are actually 2002 figures, which came out in the end of 2005, but they're 2002 figures. So we spend in 2002 over $5,200 a year. The average OECD nation spent about $2,200 a year. Germany spent $2,800, Canada $2,900, the United Kingdom $2,100. So we spend a lot more on healthcare than do our peer developed nations. And yet we have huge problems that we spent lots of this semester talking about. We've talked about 46 million uninsured. We've talked about the lack of an adequate public health system. We've talked about the lack of an adequate long-term care system. We've talked about quality of care, which on the one hand is among the best in the world, on the other hand is among the worst. I mean, there was a recent study that came out in Health Affairs a few months back, which did a study of quality and perceptions of quality among sick folks in 6 or 7 developed countries around the world. And the U.S. ended up, when it comes to things like perceptions and reality of medical error and the like, doing far worse than many other countries. So those kind of comparisons we make all the time. We know we spend more. We know we have more uninsured. But there are, I think, 5 themes that I want to just sort of leave you with or talk a little bit about with tonight that emerge when you look at the United States and you think about the United States versus some of these other industrialized countries. At the top of the list, is the fact that in every other Western industrialized country, as a moral matter, those nations, as a matter of values of those countries, those nations have made a social decision that is wrong, and that nobody in those countries ought to go without needed health care because of an inability to pay. Whether you call that value solidarity, whether you call that value community, whether you call that value respect, dignity, I mean, there's different words you can give, but each of those countries, as a matter of national proclamation, has said that we believe, in theory at least, which is not to say that those countries, and we'll talk about this, have perfect healthcare systems at all, but in theory, we're proclaiming, we're declaring, we're suggesting, we're stating, we're trying to push policy in a way that requires, that suggests that no individual in our society ought to go without needed health care because they're afraid they can't pay the bill. The United States, for a variety of reasons, which we can talk about, but for a variety of reasons, has never undertaken, never made, never said, never declared a similar moral statement. To the contrary, one of the themes that I've tried to convey over the last 14 weeks, beginning in the 18th century, you know, while I was boring you with, you know, Alexander Hamilton and Teddy Roosevelt and all the way through to the present, beginning with the 18th century through the 19th century through the 20th century, the moral theme that underlies not only health care, but social welfare policy more generally in the United States is a theme of deservingness and a theme of individual responsibility. We talked about the deserving poor, for example, earlier in the semester. We talked about the notion of welfare systems being designed and established and created to provide benefits only to the deserving poor, not to the quote-unquote undeserving poor. Well, you could similarly talk about, I think, the deserving sick and the deserving insured. And let me just give one example for both categories here in the United States. Obesity. There's a tremendous explosion of publicity in the last few years around the obesity problem here in the United States. It's a public health crisis, by all accounts, here in the United States. Much more so, actually, than in many other countries, if not most other countries around the world. Lots of talk, lots of discussion, lots of rhetoric. But actually very little, either public health or congressional or presidential or executive or administrative leadership, very little legislative action, very little congressional action, very little action at the state level, very few efforts on the part of government to deal with the problem of obesity, especially obesity among kids. When you think about why that's the case, why we've done so little there, I think it's pretty clear that one's approach to an issue like obesity depends in large part on one's assumptions about what's causing obesity, what the problem you're trying to address is, and what you can actually do about it. And here, there are really, here in the United States, two very different kinds of camps. What do you think those two camps are? What's one camp? What causes obesity according to one camp? Yeah. Right. And how do individuals cause their own obesity? They eat wrong. They don't exercise. So it's a combination. If you look at someone who's obese, you say, geez, you know, why can't that person control him or herself? Why don't they eat right? Why don't they get out and exercise? It's their fault that they're obese. And you know what? It may be true that the doctors say their quality of life would be better. They'd live longer. They'd have better lives if they weren't as obese. They wouldn't be susceptible to all sorts of disease patterns, etc. And maybe it's true also that, as the economists say, we're all going to spend more money because of the obese. But ultimately, One camp, one argument would say it's a matter of individual choice, individual responsibility. And when you think about remedies, if it's individual choice, if you believe it's individual choice, what do you do about it? If you think it's a problem, what are some of the kinds of remedies you might engage in? Education. You know, so you might say, you might try to educate people on how to eat better, how to eat wiser. Or you might say, we're going to do nothing. You know, it's not the role of government to be trying to interfere with individual choice around food. You know, I turn on the radio, I drive a lot during the day. You know, I love to listen to conservative talk radio just because I just find it fascinating to listen to, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or all those guys. I mean, I just, you know, I'm so switched back and forth between sort of WABC and Rush Limbaugh's and WFAN, listen to sports. I listen to Limbaugh as long as I can, and then I listen to Mike and the Mad Dog. I sort of go back and forth. But if you listen to a lot of conservative talk radio hosts, and you listen to a lot of sort of folks on the right, they'll say, you know what? If I want to go to McDonald's to, you know, get my food, that's my choice. And government shouldn't interfere. If I want to eat Häagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, that's my choice. If I want to sit home and watch Prison Break at 24 instead of going to the gym, that's my choice. And I don't want anyone interfering with my 24. You know, I mean, it's just a matter of choice. And government should stay out of it. Or maybe government should do some public, you know, public education. But what's another theory about why we have such a sort of problem with obesity here in the United States? Yeah. So people are forced into habits, yeah.
Marketing of the commercial food.
The marketing, the advertising, particularly advertising to kids, yeah.
The availability of health foods in certain neighborhoods that are not available to others.
Right. The dollar menu at McDonald's. Yeah. Absolutely. Anyone else? Yeah. Right, so combination of when it comes to food, you might say there's more systemic problems. It's not individuals, it's systemic. How is it systemic? Well, you know, you've got companies, whether it's the fast food industry, whether it's, you know, potato chip industry, whether it's grocery stores, whatever it is, you've got industries which are marketing low-cost, high-fat, high-sugar food, often hiding the amount of sugar in the food, marketing to kids. You know, you've got portions. I mean, now you've got a, you know, McDonald's or some of these places, I think McDonald's actually, after the movie Super Size Me came out, I guess they got rid of their super-sized portions. But, you know, you go on, you look on TV, I watch too much TV, I admit it, but you look on TV, you know, and the 7-Elevens and half these places, not only are they're advertising, you know, for 99 cents, you can get a 128-ounce drink, or a 96, you could just buy a Coke that, you know, actually would give you some exercise carrying the Coke. So, you know, you could say that, now, if you believe that there's a systemic problem, that it's a societal problem, that there's not enough places to exercise for kids, that there's, you know, companies that are engaging in inappropriate advertising, that they're not labeling their food correctly, and people don't know what they're eating, that there's poverty which leads people, you know, there's parents that have to work, or there's families in which the parents aren't home, so kids have to get quick meals, and they run to the local fast food place because that's the only place they can afford, or there's families where, you know, the mom is working and can't get home and has to have something quick and fast. I mean, if you believe that all of those issues contribute to obesity, if you believe that, you know, schools and hospitals, I mean, you go into a hospital, and generally speaking, the food in the hospital is terrible for you. I mean, it's terrible for you. And you go into a school, and half the school, actually more than half, most schools in the country, you know, you know, there's just soda and potato chips and all sorts of stuff right there available for the kids. So if you believe it's systemic, what kind of solutions do you come up with to this sort of problem? Yeah.
I mean, for the first one, when it was like individual level interventions, I mean, you come up with more structural interventions for this problem. So if it's, you know, if you decide that it's neighborhoods, I mean, you can either get the government to come in or you force, I don't know, just you change structures versus individuals.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Funding for schools so they don't have to rely on corporations like Snapple to get money into credit programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could everybody hear? She was saying, for those who couldn't hear when they're back, increase governmental program funding for, say, school-based lunches so they don't, schools don't have to rely on Snapple, like New York City, for example. Yeah. Now, how do you get McDonald's to offer healthy options or to limit the amount of, you know, fatty foods that they serve? Well,
show McDonald's that it will be profitable for them if they sell healthier foods.
And they say, well, you know what, we have nice advertisements because we like to advertise our salads because, you know, we look good when we advertise our salads or our veggie burger that we had 10 years ago. But, you know, the big seller is the 99-cent quarter pound oil. You know, Big Mac or whatever it is. You know, the economic argument, you could try, but it's a very tough, I mean, I think a lot of these companies have found that the economic argument just doesn't, at the end of the day, play out. I mean, ultimately, yeah.
You could also question for different subsidy focus as far as agricultural
absolutely, absolutely. Is there another hand back here? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And some people say that a lot of these kind of cases are going to end up in the courts because the courts become the place where they're, I mean, look at the tobacco case as an example. I mean, it ended up in the courts because legislatures weren't willing to act. It didn't act. But again, the bottom line is, if you believe it's a structural, societal, systemic problem, then you need government to act in a much more structural, societal, systemic way, and you need legislation. But if you believe, as much of sort of American culture, and sort of individualist culture believes, that this is all about deservingness or not, and again, I don't think anybody would say it's simplistically all of one or all of the other. I mean, it's clearly diet and exercise have something to do with it, and clearly some of the societal impacts that you're talking about have something to do. It's not an either-or. But when you're thinking about what government ought to do, here in the United States, there's much more of a tendency to believe in sort of notions of individualism, deservingness, and morality, rather than sort of morals as a foundation, saying everybody in the society is entitled to a basic level of health care as a sort of fundamental, equitable good. I mean, similarly around the uninsured. There's debates here in the United, you know, there's 45, 46 million uninsured. But rather than saying, as a country, as a whole, rather than saying, it's horrible that there's 45, 46 million uninsured, what can we do about that? A lot of the argument is, well, aren't there folks who really are uninsured by choice? You know, aren't there all these young folks in their 20s and 30s, like some of you guys, who are uninsured by choice? And if it's their choice, why should we, government, get involved in helping them? Aren't there uninsured who have a safety net where they could go to a community health center or a public hospital? It's really not so bad. Those are the argument among some. We talked about that when we talked about community health centers and the evolution of community health centers here in this class. There's clear notions of deservingness and a clear assumption that society, that the American political system does not have to solve the problem of 45, 46 million uninsured, because there's a lot of individual responsibility. There's a lot of individual behavior, which both leads to people being uninsured, to people being sick, to people needing healthcare costs. Fundamentally different philosophical approach, cultural approach, ideological approach between the United States and many other countries in the world. So that's one theme, one point that I wanted to suggest. A second theme, if you look at other Western industrialized countries, and one thing that becomes clear is that there's no consensus among the other Western industrialized countries about how to do national health insurance and how to raise the money for national health insurance. So if you read the case studies that I had you read, or if you look at some of the books that sort of summarize, you know, Canada, Germany, Britain, France, Italy, etc., you know, 10 different countries will do it 10 different ways. Some countries will rely on sort of Social Security payroll taxes, some countries will rely on general revenues, some countries will rely on a mix of them, some countries have, you know, the public insurance, but then you can buy supplemental private insurance. Other countries say you cannot buy supplemental private insurance for things that are given in the public sector, but you can buy supplemental and private insurance for things we don't offer in the public system. I mean, again, there's no single solution that the other countries come up with in how to finance national health insurance, and there's no single solution that the countries come up with in terms of what the benefit package should look like. But there is, in all of those other countries, there is clearly leadership at the national level. Not at the state level, not at the provincial level, not at the county level, not at the city level, not at the community level. There is leadership at the national level, whether you're talking about Great Britain or Canada or Germany or France or Italy or Luxembourg or, you know, whatever country you're talking about, Japan. There is leadership at the national level saying, this is the rules of the game. These are the rules of the game. This is how we're going to raise the money. And you know what? That requires taxes. That requires, whether it's general revenue taxes, whether it's payroll taxes, this is how we're going to raise the money. And this is what the roles of the different players are going to be. You know, we're going to give the provinces in Canada responsibility for figuring out what the delivery system should look like, and we're going to give the provinces lots of responsibility, but they all have to provide universal, portable, comprehensive coverage. So the feds set the rules of the game in those other countries. And the feds talk about taxes, revenue. What about the United States? What's the perception of the role of the federal government?
It's hostile.
There is a strong anti-government, but particularly anti-federal government ethos, culture here in the United States. The notion of the national government setting the rules for the health insurance system is not a notion that can, will, or has gone very far. There is much more of an assumption that, again, sort of the flip side, remember the whole English poor law system that we talked about, half of it was sort of the deserving poor, the other half of it was that local governments, not the national government, have the responsibility, have the obligation, have the authority to engage in that kind of social welfare policy. And while it's true that over the last 70 years, post-New Deal, post-1935, the role of the federal government has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. The agenda of the federal government has gotten larger and larger and larger and larger. And that's true as well in the last 30 years. And that's true under Richard Nixon, it's true under George Bush, it's true under George Bush, the current George Bush. I mean, it was the only president that probably arguably reduced the role of the federal government, you know, in the last 80 years has been Ronald Reagan. But every other Republican president, and he certainly increased the size of the national military, but every other president, Republican, Democrat alike, including the current administration, has dramatically increased the size and scope of the federal authority and responsibility. But at the same time, every one of those presidents, whether they're, you know, George Bush or Bill Clinton, every one of those presidents has talked about the need for leadership at the state and local level. Every one of those presidents has espoused an anti-government ethos. Every one of those presidents has said, less is better. And that rhetoric shapes politics. And that rhetoric shapes and continues sort of the individualistic anti-government culture, particularly the individualistic anti-national government culture that we have here in the United States. And that's a very, very sharp distinction as well between the United States and other countries, other Western industrialized countries. Now, again, you can look at the, you know, 10, 15, 20 different Western industrialized countries. They have different variations of federalism. They have different sets of relationships between the national authorities and state and local authorities. But in all of them, the national or the federal government sets the rules of the system. Much less so here in the United States. And today, the national government is less enthusiastic than ever, or so it says, about national health reform, about the uninsured. So there's some activity at the state and local level. You know, I mean, there are some states, whether it's Massachusetts, whether it's Arkansas, whether it's Illinois, there are some states that are engaging in interesting and important experiments. But we're never, in the United States, and I know I probably shouldn't say never, but I think I can say never here, we're never going to achieve sort of a comprehensive health reform system here in the United States if it's led by state and local governments. Anyone can disagree with me if they want. I mean, this is the last hour. I'm figuring, what the hell, you know? But you need national leadership. A third theme that I think emerges when you look at all the Western industrialized countries is that all of them, in 2006. Worry about rising costs. I don't care if you're France, Germany, Canada, Britain, I don't care who you are. Japan, China, Korea, I don't care who you are. You worry about rising costs because the same kinds of factors lead to rising costs everywhere. I mean, it's the same list. It's demographics. It's the aging of societies. It's technology, it's the development of new technologies, it's rising expectations among consumers as to the kind of healthcare services they want. I mean, those factors, technology, demographics, expectations, those factors are just as important and just as dominant in every Western industrialized country in the world. I mean, all you have to do, forget healthcare, all you have to do is look at all the strikes they have in France. I mean, European countries are struggling tremendously with trying to figure out how to accommodate their social welfare systems, which include their healthcare systems, with some of these large economic trends, with some of these large demographic trends, and certainly with some of these large technological trends. But when dealing with things like the need to contain costs, the other countries in the world do it very, very differently from the United States. Just about every other country in the world, if not every other country in the world with national health insurance, does a couple of things that the United States doesn't do. Let me ask you, if If you had to say what's the one reason, if you had to pick just one reason that you think the United States spends $5,200 per capita and all these other countries spend $2,000, $2,500 per capita, what would the one factor that distinguishes them, the cost of healthcare in the United States from here, from other countries, be in your mind? And I'll tell you what studies seem to suggest. What do you think it is? Yeah.
Choice.
Choice meaning? Although in theory, that would suggest, you know, in a country like France, where you could just go to any doctor you want, you would think costs would be much higher then, because basically it's all paid for, everything's paid for, you don't have to worry about it. I mean, all the kinds of things that managed care here in the United States was designed to, you know, get at, a lot of other countries with sort of public insurance, fee-for-service systems. Excuse me?
They don't cover everything.
Yeah, but they don't cover everything, but they cover a lot more than the basic benefit package here in the United States. Yeah?
The cost of prescription drugs.
The cost of prescription drugs. Anyone else? Yeah?
Employer-based
solely? Meaning, the administrative costs you're talking about from a private system? Employer-based system? Okay, administrative costs. Yeah?
Technology and demand for it?
Technology and demand. Yeah.
We spend a lot of money on the very elderly doing all sorts of extreme measures.
Sort of last-minute, end-of-life spending. Again, this is I'm looking for distinguishing characteristics between us and other countries.
The cost of emergency services.
Emergency services, yeah.
Other countries have cutoffs for medical, for offering medical services, like being a certain age.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So that's actually similar to the point about end-of-life care, absolutely. All of those things are variables. All of them are factors. All of them are right. But what the studies suggest is the single factor that distinguishes the cost of care in the United States and the cost of care in all these other care countries is price. It's price. It's what we pay doctors. It's what we pay providers. It's what we pay hospitals. All of the other countries that have national health insurance essentially engage in a series of negotiations with the providers in those countries, with the doctors and others. Many of those other countries are now entering into global budgets and sort of spending caps, in which they basically say, we're not going to spend any more than this. Here's what we're going to spend. How are we going to work out reimbursement with you? And the doctors and the providers and the non-physician providers and the associations for those groups negotiate with government. And again, each country does it a little bit differently. But there's ongoing negotiations over price. And so that the price of a hospital stay, forget about the services that you receive, but the cost of a day in a hospital in New York or in the United States compared to the cost of a day in a hospital in Germany or France or Canada or Britain or any other country in the world is just dramatically, dramatically different. It just costs more. We pay more. Government regulates prices. Providers make less money. There are global caps. Governments, and we talked in this class, we spent a week on workforce policy, and sort of I described the failed debacle of Clinton's workforce initiative. Remember, Clinton was proposing that 55% of all residents, all newly minted docs, be generalists. He wanted fewer specialists, more primary care docs. Other countries, and he got nowhere with that. We talked about how it was a political non-starter. Most other countries in the world control that. They regulate it, for better or worse. They have far fewer specialists, far more primary care docs. They actually spend more days in the hospital than many other countries, and many of them use a lot more drugs. I mean, many other countries use prescription drugs much more than the United States. And yet the cost of those drugs is just much, much, much less. The cost of those hospital days is much less. There's much less technology. there's some statistics in the article that I was just talking about, which looks at the number of CAT scan machines, you know, in all the different OECD countries. Now, some countries, like Japan, has way more than just about any other country in the world. So on that particular criteria, they're high. But the U.S. is way up there. Many other countries are very low. Other countries actually, as a regulatory matter, figure out how they want to spend their money. In the United States, you can't say that the government doesn't have any role to play when it comes to reimbursing providers, because of course they do. How do they have a role? Where do they have a role, a primary role? Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, it's certainly the case that government decides how much they're going to pay doctors in Medicare. And in fact, there's huge controversy over how much Medicare and Medicaid pay docs in those programs. And docs feel hugely underpaid by both of those programs, particularly Medicaid, but these days often Medicare as well. But the government has never said that it's going to try to regulate the cost of healthcare more generally beyond the programs that government itself pays for. The United States government has never said, despite Bill Clinton's proposal, that we're going to regulate the mix, the specialty mix of our providers. And despite the existence of theoretical certificate of need laws in states, which are supposed to, in theory anyway, regulate the amount of new technology, essentially, the more is better. And there's very little effort to regulate technology. So some of the kinds of, you know, a couple of you commented on, you know, other countries may not use as many high-tech or last-minute devices with the elderly or with other folks, so there might be slightly longer waiting periods for certain kind of elective procedures. Those things exist. But they exist in large part because the government in those countries, the national government typically in those countries, is making decisions about how and where it wants to allocate its money. Again, those kinds of decisions run completely contrary to sort of the American culture, American ethic, American way of doing things. So again, I'm not saying right or wrong here. I'm just saying if you want to look at how the United States differs from many of these other countries around the world, that's yet a third area in which we differ significantly. A fourth theme, and here actually this one was pointed out to me by Larry Brown here at the School of Public Health, a political scientist. I mean, Larry actually noticed, and he thought it was very interesting, that a number of years ago, many of the European countries began embracing notions of competition and markets and managed care. And he tried to think about, figure out, you know, where was that coming from? What did that all mean? You know, why were those other countries embracing those American systems where they had national health insurance, they had low costs, we had no national health insurance, we had high costs, and we had lots of uninsured. Why were they embracing our systems of cost-effectiveness research and outcomes? Why were they embracing our systems of care management and managed care? What do you think was going on here? Some real good stuff out of you on this. Go ahead.
But no, just in general, like for example, countries like France, who of course need to have kind of
Anybody else want to add something on that? You have to write a final exam for Larry on that topic? Come on, test out your final answer, your final exam answer. Well, you know, anybody else have a thought on sort of what's going on in other countries around markets and competition and managed care? Well, I actually think you hit on the key points. Other countries began to see that when you have a fee-for-service payment system in which care is provided without any cost to the consumer, you're going to have problems with lack of coordinated care. You're going to have problems with overuse of care. You're going to have problems with rising costs. All of those things are going to be problems. And so other countries have looked to some American models, whether it's managed care, whether it's cost-effectiveness research, whether it's disease management, whether it's efforts to infuse competition into their healthcare systems. But as Larry would point out to those of you who took this class or are taking this class, and as the evidence clearly suggests, there's a big difference between the tinkering with markets and the tinkering with managed care, whether it's in Britain or whatever country you look at, or France, the tinkering with competition in those countries. Because that tinkering takes place, and this sort of moves back to sort of point number two, that tinkering takes place in a context in which a national regulatory environment still controls. So there's tinkering with efforts to try to manage care, have more coordinated care, have more cost-effective care, have more competition in the system. I mean, Germany, for example, let's use one example. In Germany, everybody gets health insurance through what are known as these sickness funds. You know, it's kind of like health insurance funds, systems. And historically, you got that health insurance based on where you worked and what profession you were in. So if you were, you know, a school teacher, you were in one fund. If you were a construction worker, you were in another fund. If you were a politician, you were in another fund. And most Germans got and get their health care insurance through these funds. I mean, you can opt out of that system. Again, I don't want to get into too many details about the German system because it'll just bog us down. But that's the way the system generally works. Well, a few years ago, the Germans decided, well, geez, maybe we want to have more competition among these sickness funds. And so they began giving people choice, competitive choice, to pick which sickness fund they wanted to join and belong to. Well, it turned out pretty much everybody has stayed in the sickness fund to which they always belonged, and which their family and their relatives and their grandfather always belonged. People haven't really exercised the choice, but that effort to bring in some competition in Germany or in France, the effort in many European countries to try to coordinate care through the use of primary care gatekeepers, those efforts take place in a system, in a context in which the rules of the game, again, are set by the national government. It's not as if Germany said, you know, we're not going to require, that everybody have available to them some sort of sickness fund. We're going to abolish national health insurance. We're going to abolish compulsory insurance. It's not as if Germany said that. They said, we'll tinker with competition, but we're going to keep the core regulatory approach in place. In contrast, here in the United States, again, pulling back from my, overly zealous comments before, again, for right or for wrong, for better or for worse, there's a much stronger philosophical, ideological, cultural belief in markets, in competition, and a much, much stronger ideological and cultural opposition to government regulation. Even though there's government regulation everywhere, much stronger opposition to government regulation. And so the notion, so it's kind of like we start, I mean, if you look at President Bush's, you know, agenda for the uninsured, if you look at his agenda and his rhetoric for reducing costs, it's all around markets, competition. It's all around the private sector. Now, does that's the rhetoric. Does that mean that the proposals are all private sector proposals? No. I mean, clearly, you know, health savings accounts are very heavily regulated. Clearly, Bush's efforts to create association health plans to allow small businesses to sign up would be very heavily regulated. But the dynamic, the political dynamic here in the United States is one which suggests that competition and markets are the way to go, regulation is not the way to go, and that's a vast difference between the United States and about every other country in the Western industrialized world. Now, if you look at one last difference, actually, that I want to mention, actually has to do with consumer satisfaction. Consumer satisfaction is much higher in other countries than it is in the United States. Why do you think that is?
Yeah.
Is
that
they're not paying for it? Well, although arguably they're paying for it through taxes that are much higher than the taxes that we pay in the United States, and that's what George Bush would say, anyway. Yeah?
Because there are no gatekeepers, they can choose whatever service they choose, whatever provider they like.
Now, and that's certainly historically been the case, although many European and other countries are beginning to impose gatekeepers for the first time. But you're absolutely right. They've had much more freedom of choice. They've had coverage. And they have a perception that the system is basically fair and equitable, and that everybody gets the same thing. It may not be perfect, but it's our system. You know, for us French, or for us Italians, or for us Germans, or for us Brits, or for us Japanese, or for us whoever, it's our system. And we all get the same benefits because we are British, or we are French. It's one of the rights that accrue to us as a citizen of our country. And while we may complain and kvetch about our doctor, while we may complain and kvetch that they now require some gatekeepers, we may complain and kvetch that they're changing the system a little bit, basically, most citizens feel quite a bit of pride in many of these countries around their healthcare system. Here in the United States, again, for better or for worse, there is not a single system. We don't have a system. We have a non-system. An unsystem. Like the Uncola. We have an unsystem. Everything's a commercial with me, yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, they say there's a human right not to unlimited health care benefits, but there's a right to a basic minimal level of care. And we as a society have defined what that basic level of minimal care is, and nobody in our society should go without these basic services because of an inability to pay. And the United States has never done that. We flirted in the United States. You know, we talked a little about in this class the courts and the period in the 1960s when the Supreme Court flirted with an expanding definition of fundamental constitutional rights. And so the court found there was a right to privacy, which became the basis, even though the Constitution doesn't anywhere say, you know, there's a right to privacy. It doesn't say in the Bill of Rights you have a right to privacy, but the court in Griswold and subsequently in Roe held there was a right to privacy. The court flirted with the argument that there was a right to a free public education in the United States. The court flirted with the right, with the notion that there was a right to welfare. And the court and other advocates flirted with the idea that there ought to be a constitutionally protected right to a basic minimum level of health care. But we've never, the courts, as quickly as they flirted with that in the early 70s, they backed off. Remember, we talked about how the courts go back and forth, back and forth. Well, they backed off their expanding definition of fundamental rights. And we've never declared there's a fundamental constitutional right to health care, never declared a fundamental constitutional right to a basic minimal level, welfare services, and the like. We implicitly, I suppose, come as close as we can to saying there's a fundamental right to health care, you know, for young kids around certain basic things like immunizations. You know, so we will say, you know what, every young kid ought to have the right to at least go to a health department clinic and get the immunizations they need, whether or not they can afford health care. That group and those set of services are as close as the society we come. We've also, through statute, what's EMTALA? Who knows what EMTALA is? Statute EMTALA. Yeah. Yeah.
It's basically that any hospital, like, is entitled to any Medicaid
facility. This is supposed to be given care to anybody who's in the hospital. And why was
EMTALA enacted, do you think? In 1985, I think, because sometimes some of the, like, well, the reason is still, well, it's not that it's not happening, but the reason is because people couldn't afford health care. They just go up to the private hospital. They would end up being sent to a public hospital. So there would be a lot of trafficking of basic education.
Right, there was a lot of what was known as patient dumping going on, where emergency rooms would say to the ambulance drivers, don't bring those patients, those poor uninsured patients, to our emergency room. You know, take them down the block. You know, we don't want to serve them here. Or if people would show up at the ER, you're right, they would be transferred elsewhere. And so Congress said, if you accept federal health care funds through these federal programs, you have to at least take a look at and stabilize and diagnose and stabilize anybody who shows up in the emergency room before transferring them elsewhere, even if they can't afford to pay. That's probably as close to a statutory right to a certain level of health care as we have in the United States. So young kids have sort of an unspoken, implicit right to get the immunizations they need. Everybody these days has a legal right to show up at an ER and at least be diagnosed and stabilized. But that's about it. That's about it. And that hospital that stabilizes you doesn't have to keep you once you've been stabilized. If you can't pay the bill, if you don't have insurance, if you can't figure out how you're going to pay the bill, they don't have to keep you. They can transfer you. And they can in particular transfer you to a public facility, which pretty much will take anybody who walks on the door, except there's not public facilities in every community. So that's about as close as we've come to a fundamental right here, yeah.
What do they consider a stable?
Now you've gone beyond me. I made it to about 8 minutes to eight on the last. I don't, you know, medically I'm not sure. I think that's my guess is there's sort of both been legal and medical debates about the definition of stable, you know, of stabilizing someone under EMTALA and exactly what hospitals have to do prior to letting you go. Any of the ER docs here want to? Yeah. Well, it's a pretty low standard.
Yeah.
I know that. It's a pretty low standard.
Yeah.
And the courts have not, you know, there was an assumption among some advocates. You know, when you look at the role of the courts here in the United States, some would say that the courts could and should have played and play a much more significant role in enforcing healthcare access here in the United States than the courts have in the last 50 years. And one of the areas that the courts get let me give you a couple of areas in which the courts get, you know, criticized by at least some. And one is EMTALA. I mean, the courts have not, according to some anyway, and I'm not an expert, as I said, on what it means to stabilize, But the argument that some would make is that the courts have not put any teeth into that law. You know, they basically allow providers tremendous amounts of discretion to decide what it means to stabilize. Similarly, the courts did not put for a long time any teeth into Hill-Burton that we talked about earlier this semester. Hill-Burton requires hospitals to treat, you know, folks in the community and to provide certain levels of care to the uninsured in that community as a condition of the federal money received to help build and expand the hospital. The courts have not done a very aggressive assertive job of trying to push and hold hospitals to the Hill-Burton obligations. Similarly around Medicaid, the courts have not been a player in Medicaid at all over the years. And look, around ERISA, the courts, as we've talked about in this class, and as you wrote in your memos in this class, the courts have basically deferred to Congress to try to deal with the equitable issues raised by the way ERISA has been interpreted and has played out over the years. So the courts have not played a major role there. All right, so when you sort of step back and you think, all right, the United States is, for ideological reasons, for interest group reasons, for cultural reasons, for institutional reasons, it's different than these other countries. So you could do these kinds of comparisons, and you could say, well, these are the ways in which the courts differ, of course, these are the ways in which the United States differ. You know, we don't have the same sort of moral underpinning. We have a different moral underpinning, rightly or wrongly. We don't have the same conception of the role of national leadership. We have a different conception of what the role of national involvement in social welfare should be. We don't have the same set of understandings and relationships about how you contain costs and what the role of government should be. We don't have the same set of understandings and perceptions and beliefs about the roles of markets and markets versus regulation. We're very different. You then have to say to yourself, well, is this still on? Yeah, okay. I don't believe I'm just started talking. I think what he did was he put the thing in his pocket and he hit the mute button. But then I didn't want to interrupt him. But anyway. I lost my train of thought. So you look at these other countries. And you say, okay, the United States is different from these other countries in these various ways. What's the message? What difference does it make? As a citizen of the United States, as someone who's in this country, what can you learn that's useful from other countries? How can you learn from other countries? I mean, I've read actually about 20 or 25 of the short 500-word essays that some people made into 700-word essays, which they shouldn't have. But, I've read a bunch of the essays that you've read, and they're pretty good, actually. They're really pretty good essays that people wrote, in which they said, here's a policy in another country, here's something the United States should learn. What's the value, do you think, of sort of looking comparatively? What's the value of looking at other countries and trying to think about lessons from the United States? And how do you begin to think about taking some of the lessons that you might see in other countries and applying them here in the United States? Any thoughts on that? Yeah.
I mean, like if you look at it comparatively, I mean, if you find a system that works, you know, and you know that here something's not working, I mean, the best you can do is to try to figure out, take the differences that you think you have
in this country, but figure out how could you take that system in another country and somehow, with all the differences, make it work here if you know it has success. Yeah, and I don't think there's a single answer to this. I mean, a lot of times people read case studies of other countries, or think about, you know, the health insurance or the healthcare systems of other countries, and at the end of the day, they kind of say, so what? You know, how is that going to help us, you know, generate change here in the United States? How are we going to take... How are we going to take lessons from other countries? I don't have an answer to that. Anybody else have any thoughts about it? I mean, I think... Yeah.
I'm just thinking, to kind of extend on Emma's, there's a familiarity with what's going on in other countries, but to actually really critically
Yeah.
There's also kind of a danger in that, because if you're taking something out of context and you're not thinking about the infrastructure of the country in general.
Mm-hmm. It is tricky. Yeah. Right. No, absolutely. Right. Right. Right, absolutely. One thing that I didn't mention is we don't do very well here in the United States on cross-national comparisons on things like infant mortality rates. And, I mean, there's a whole series of health indicators that, despite the $5,200 per capita that we spend, we don't do very well on. So one could try to make sort of a moral argument based on that. Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly the notion of sort of states as policy laboratories, you know, dates back, you know, to Justice Louis Brandeis and his famous comments, you know, that the states are these policy laboratories and they should try and test ideas and we'll see how they play out. You know, and certainly I think that's what Mitt Romney would say in Massachusetts right now, that we're going to try and test an individual mandate and we're going to see how it works here and we'll see how it plays out and other states can adopt or not adopt as they see fit. My own sense is that the states have actually been far less successful as policy laboratories than one would think they should be. And why do you think that is? Number one, they don't have the money. They don't have the money. Number two, when you talk about replicating ideas from one state to another, you know, the same kind of debates we get into about is the United States different from France, Germany, and Britain, and why should we adopt what they adopt? Well, the United States is a huge country. And if you look at, it was actually an interesting article in the Times a couple of weeks ago talking about just the extraordinary variation in state policy these days in a whole host of areas, not just healthcare, but a whole host of areas. One could make the argument we're, in certain respects, 50 separate countries. And culturally, I think, you know, there's a whole field of political science which basically, you know, looks at the political cultures of different states and has divided the political, you know, has, you know, this particular, you know, school basically says there's three different political, I've talked generally here about the political culture of the United States. There are some political scientists who would say I'm way overgeneralizing. And they divide the United States into three sort of different kind of political cultures. One, a group of states that they consider to be moralistic states, another one they consider to be traditional. You know, there's these three different groupings. And so replicating ideas from state to state is hard. So states don't have the money, they often don't have the infrastructure, and replication is very hard. So for lots of reasons, personally, I don't think the states are particularly great laboratories. But certainly it's an open question, and I urge you to think about it. I mean, one of the things I'm looking forward to sort of in my own sort of personal life is, you know, I'm taking over actually very soon as the editor of this journal, the Journal of Health Politics, Policy and Law, JHPL, which is this political science health policy journal. And so I've already sort of started, even though I don't officially take over until July 1, I'm sort of unofficially sort of have already taken over for a variety of reasons. And so I'm actually looking at, you know, much more carefully a whole host of different kind of articles on a whole host of different kinds of things. And one of the big debates, which we may even have a special issue on, and which you can, you know, you can also submit something, is sort of the role of federalism in the United States, the role of states in the United States compared to the role of federalism in cross-nationally. These are ongoing issues. We can't and won't solve them here. I think it's important to expose you in a class like this to at least a basic introduction to how some of the other industrialized countries handle some of the issues that we handle, just like I think it's equally important to expose you to the kind of things that Jeff exposed you to in the first half of this class around some of the just horrendous conditions that are taking place at the, you know, while we're sitting here in this classroom in 401 Hammer, as we speak, people are dying, you know, in huge numbers of malaria, TB, AIDS, etc., in sub-Saharan Africa. I think it's important to expose you to the basic kind of introduction to the healthcare system, the evolution of the healthcare system here in the United States. But it really is just an introduction. All of these things are just introductions. And I suppose that's why it's a core class as opposed to a more advanced seminar class. But I hope that some of the things we've done here pique your interest a little bit. And I think we're about done. So good luck to you all, and I'll see you soon.